intellectual property law and the privatization of everything under the sun. And I think this talk is a development of much of Camus' work up to this point. Camus went to the same undergraduate college in the U.S. that I did, James Madison. But it was there where he developed a very keen interest in intellectual property law and copyright. And I think it was there that he developed a real interest in sociology and communications. And that has taken him to where he is today. And in between, Kemmerer has written several academic articles. He's written two books, Freedom of Expression was the latest, and his first was called Owning Culture. He's also produced the documentary Money for Nothing, which is an examination of the music industry in the United States. And he's currently working on the history of sampling in hip-hop music. So I won't go on for too long, but it's great to have Kemmerer here and the other folks talk.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Please save your applause until you think I deserve it. Thanks so much for your introduction, and thanks for having me. The last phrase in the title of my talk, the privatization of everything under the sun, refers to a phrase in a very important United States Supreme Court decision that allowed for, it was the first Supreme Court in the world to make legal the privatization of genetic matter. It was the first time that a Supreme Court had created a case law, law of the land, that said that even living organisms could be privately owned. And in that decision, they stated, the judges stated that, quote, everything under the sun made by man can be privatized. So, fast forward another 20 years, and we have one in the United States and yet another example of yet another law just anywhere in the world, new intellectual property law that had been introduced that had severe and extreme impact on a variety of forms of creativity and innovation. And in the United States, it is called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And in other countries, Australia, EU, elsewhere, adopted very similar laws, although under different names. But I'll just refer to it as the DMCA. And I just wanted to use that as a jumping off point as an example of the ways that intellectual property laws have continued to expand since that 1980 Supreme Court decision that allowed for the privatization of genetic matter to privatize all sorts of other kinds of activities. And in this case, the DMCA was written to protect digital property by making it illegal to bypass certain digital locks, such as copy protection on software programs, whether they be passwords, or CDs. Many CDs in the EU, it's my understanding, have copy protection encryptions on it that make it difficult to make copies of CDs. So the law, this law and the laws in other countries make it illegal to bypass those kinds of copy protections. And it's a terrible law for a number of reasons, because first of all, it's failed to prevent unauthorized duplication of copyrighted goods, because anyone who surfed the internet would know that. And it's only succeeded in stunting innovation and criminalizing legitimate research, including and especially academic research, and arresting the development of worthwhile software. And sometimes it's actually led to the arrest of actual software developers themselves. One of the DMCA's unintended consequences is that companies have tried to squash it to prevent such things as garage door openers or aftermarket ink cartridges, things that you just wouldn't even consider being affected, that it would be affected by a copyright law. So only in America, you might think, but as I said, these draconian types of laws that protect digital property are spreading around the globe like digital wildfire. In 2004, a 33-year-old assistant professor at the University of Tokyo was arrested because he had developed a file-sharing software program similar to the popular Kazaa application. And that same year, the Italian Parliament passed a law imposing jail time up to 3 years for anyone caught appropriating copyrighted material on the internet. So this is yet another unfortunate outcome of the drive to privatize every imaginable thing in the world, including, as I mentioned, genetic material. And so the peculiar case of an American man named John Moore is instructive. And this couldn't have happened without that Supreme Court decision and then other similar kinds of laws that had been passed. The EU, for instance, also allows for the privatization of genetic material. When John Moore went to the hospital in the mid-1980s, his spleen was removed to treat a rare form of leukemia. And the University of California, well, his doctor, that is, patented the cell line that was developed from his organ because his organ was quite unique, although it was without John Moore's knowledge or permission. And the long-term market value of this patent has been estimated at roughly $3 billion U.S. dollars, and Moore's doctor received about $3 million in stocks from the Genetics Institute, the firm that marketed and developed the drug based on that cell line that was based on his spleen. So when Moore found out about these shenanigans, he sued, but he lost. The California Supreme Court ruled that giving Moore any sorts of rights over his genetic material would lead to, quote, the commodification of the human body, an argument that ruffled the feathers of one of the few judges that dissented from this particular decision. And Judge Brossard wrote, quote, far from elevating these biological materials above the marketplace, the majority's holding simply bars plaintiff, the source of the cells, from obtaining the benefit of the cell's value, but permits the defendants, who allegedly obtains the cells from the plaintiff by improper means, to retain and exploit the full economic value of their ill-gotten gains. So, flash forward 10 years from 1988, when this case was decided, to 1998. And there was a scientist named Francis Collins singing on stage, and he's saying, this gene is your gene, this gene is my gene. And he continued, and he was backed up by the lumbering roar of a middle-aged rock band. This was no ordinary club gig. Francis Collins was singing at a post-press conference party for scientists, and he was the one who spearheaded the U.S. Human Genome Project, which was funded by a government agency, and he was trying to make an ethical and political point. Since the mid-1990s, his organization had raced against the private effort to map the human genome in order to make... From his perspective, he wanted to make our genetic material freely accessible for all, not privately owned and patented by a handful of corporations. Any scientist could examine his or his organization's genome map for free, unlike Celera Genomics Drafts, the primary private company that was racing against the public effort, which published this information with strings attached. And so he continued, this draft is your draft, this draft is my draft, and it's a free draft, no charge to see draft. It's our instruction book, so come on, have a look. This draft was made for you and me. So he reworked Woody Guthrie, the American folk singer, his song, This Land is Your Land, to argue that genetic information should be freely available to the scientific community. However, his use of the Woody Guthrie song, it was sadly ironic on many levels. Let me explain a couple. This Land is Your Land, the song, was written by an unabashed socialist as a tribute to the idea of communal property, as in, this land was made for you and me. Another key lyric goes, a sign was painted, private property, but on the backside it didn't say nothing. So the folk song tradition from which Woody Guthrie came valued the open borrowing of lyrics and melodies. Culture was meant to be freely created and recreated in a democratic, participatory way. If this was so, then why was Collins's use of This Land is Your Land painfully ironic, the phrase I used? Well, even though it was written over 60 years ago, the song is, to quote Woody Guthrie himself, still private property. Guthrie based the melody of This Land Is Your Land on a Carter Family song, an American country group, their 1928 recording, Little Darling Pal of Mine, which in turn, the melody was derived from a 19th century gospel song called Oh, My Living Brother. So this means that in the 21st century, the publishing company that owns this dead socialist's music catalog can earn money, still earn money, and it still does earn money, from a song about communal property that itself was based on a tune from the 19th century. Far more disturbing, Guthrie's publishing company prevents musicians from releasing altered, updated lyrical versions of the song, so we won't be hearing Francis Collins' mutated cover of This Gene Is Your Gene anytime soon. So, as I take a breath, I bet you're probably wondering, what's the connection between folk music and genetic material or genetic research? The two couldn't seem further apart. Although obviously really different endeavors, the practice of creating folk music and doing and researching genes, although they're obviously different endeavors, both used to, value the open sharing of information, whether it's melodies with regard to folk music or scientific data with regard to genetics. In these communities, texts were often considered private property, but today this has been fundamentally altered by the process of privatization. You probably are very familiar with the term, but to just sum it up, privatization is the belief that shared public resources, sometimes referred to economists and social scientists as the commons, public resources, can be better managed by private industries. And in recent years, there's been a significant erosion of both the cultural commons and the genetic commons, resulting in a shrinking of the public domain. And public domain, in the legal sense, refers to intellectual properties that whose copyrights have lapsed. So if Woody Guthrie, if the U.S. hadn't extended the term of copyright protection by another 20 years, which it had done in 1998, then Woody Guthrie's song would soon enter the public domain. Another way that something can be in the public domain is if, well, it was never protected by intellectual property laws in the first place, such as genetic material before 1980. So the fact that folk melodies and lyrics are now privately owned rather than shared resources is, to me, a depressing example of how our cultural commons is being fenced off. And as for the genetic commons, the patenting of human and plant genes is just the furthest logical extension of privatization, taken at times to illogical lengths. So the public domain, a commons that can be freely drawn from, runs counter from the guiding ideology of our hyper-commercialized free market age. The dynamic of privatization is an overpowering one. Much of what we hear in the mainstream news, particularly in the U.S., what I hear, is a coded message that says everything should be up for sale, including our genetic heritage, our bodies, ourselves. The pressure to pin down every gene and place it in a locked container, a legally locked container, has also fundamentally altered the longstanding scientific norms of sharing and openness in the field of genetics, replacing them with secrecy and closure. It has eroded the scientific commons of genetic information, and scientific insiders have argued, that it has made it even more difficult for researchers to do their scientific work. The existence of a commons encourages creativity, I argue, as do others, in both art and science, because this kind of openness allows people to build on other people's discoveries and creations. As Sir Isaac Newton put it 3 centuries ago, if I see further, it's because I stand on the shoulders of giants. But the shrinkage of the genetic commons increases the need to obtain permission from patent owners if a researcher wants to use privately owned genes. And similarly, rather than being able to freely draw from melodies and lyrics, as Woody Guthrie once did, and other folk musicians similar to him, today's musicians have to get consent of song publishers before they can alter a tune like This Land Is Your Land. So in both cases, the creative process is bureaucratized and monetized, lowering the chances that the kinds of unintentional epiphanies that occur when we have more freedom to experiment will happen, whether we're talking about music or we're talking about science. Continuing with the scientific example. Today, in the field of genetics, the idea that an open scientific commons, where knowledge is freely shared, seems almost quaint, rather than something that was central to Western science for centuries. With some exceptions, but it was largely the norm. Noted microbiologist Emmanuel Epstein says that, quote, "In the past, it was the most natural thing in the world for colleagues to swap ideas at the spur of the moment, to share the latest findings hot off the counter, or to show early drafts of papers to each other, and in other such ways to act as champions and companions in zealous research," he writes. Now, he says simply, no more. The logic of privatization has fundamentally transformed legal and philosophical assumptions about human life, converting life into a product and an immensely profitable one. John Sulston, who won the Nobel Prize for spearheading the British effort to map the human genome, said, we in Western society are going through a period of intensifying belief in private ownership to the detriment of the public good," end quote. So, gift economies, sort of the inverse of this, the logic of privatization, are potent systems for eliciting and developing behaviors that the market cannot, behaviors the market cannot sustain. Sharing, collaboration, honor, trust, sociability, loyalty. In this capacity, gift economies are both an important force in creating wealth, both the kind of material wealth prized by the market, as well as the social and spiritual kind needed to engage in a happy and integrated life. So we should remember that, of course, market norms, which are often taken to the extreme by some private industries, run counter to social norms such as ethics. And it's true that privatization sometimes succeeds in improving service and efficiency, but privatizations that go bad can often be catastrophic. We see this time and time again with the privatization schemes insisted upon by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz said during his time at the World Bank, quote, "I saw decisions that were made because of ideology and politics. And as a result, many wrong-headed actions were taken, ones that didn't solve the problem at hand, but that fit the interests or beliefs of the people in power," end quote. So private corporations argue that they alone, can better manage the commonwealth, whether we're talking about national parks, or the radio spectrum, or water supplies, for instance, a wealth that is supposed to belong to all. And they say something like, "Corporate management is obviously more ideal because market norms are the grease that lubricate the wheels of efficiency and innovation, yada, yada, yada." So put that way, it's hard to imagine another system ever working, but one did, and for decades. Some things were purchased, some things were freely traded, but not everything was nailed down with a price tag and managed by private efforts. So returning to this idea of the commons, an idea that I'll continue to develop, the commons is an essential part of what some economists and social scientists refer to as that gift economy I mentioned earlier. Just to bring this into a very contemporary context, today's very successful open source software movement, and the rise of the internet itself is proof that a gift economy still exists and it thrives. And so, open source software, just curious, raise your hand if you are familiar with the term or know what open source software is, which is about half of you. So I'll just very quickly explain. Open source software refers to a kind of software that is developed communally, and it's become increasingly popular with the rise of integrated networks that the internet has allowed to come into being. And an open source software program, for example, would be a program like Linux, which is an alternative to the PC Microsoft-based Windows program that operates a computer. Linux was created by many thousands, tens of thousands of people, and was written and then bettered and improved, and it continues to exist today. But there are many, many other examples of open source software, but hopefully that will suffice as an explanation. So the openness of open source software allows many people to collaborate and build upon other people's ideas, as I said, which are then transformed into something that is often new and unexpected. And this is because the open source code can be copied and freely built upon by an army of volunteers, as opposed to Microsoft, which is on this machine, I noticed, which is a closed code that no one has access to, and if you do try and access that code, you're breaking the law. So another example of, aside from Linux, of a successful open source software program is the fact that Sendmail, this open source program called Sendmail, routes over 80% of all email traffic on the internet, I mean, globally. And Linux commands, as of 2002, 27% of the server market. And I don't have the latest figures, but what I can tell, that certainly has grown and will continue to grow, especially because especially developing countries are increasingly using open source software programs such as Linux. And so governments such as Thailand, India, Bavaria, and the list goes on. Richard Stallman, the founder of the Free Software Foundation. Free Software Foundation is kind of a cousin of it's a highly contentious thing because, like many marginalized groups, there's a lot of infighting. So, for instance, free software is much like open software. The two terms, to the layperson, could be easily exchanged because they operate under the same principles, which is, you know, the code should be open and it should be built upon, and it should and can be built upon. And if you build new innovations into the code, you can't copyright it. You have to release it. You have to release your improvements to the rest of the world. Because of the infighting, which is too complicated to get into, I'll just say that open software and free software are quite similar. And so the founder of this Free Software Foundation, Richard Stallman, explains that the use of the word free isn't economic. It's not a free isn't a used in an economic sense. It's more like free as in free speech, not free as in free beer. Stanford law professor Lawrence Lessig explains that a resource is free when, first, one can use it without permission of the permission of anyone else, and two, the permission one needs to be granted neutrally, so that if permission is granted, everyone has the opportunity to be granted that. The rules are the same for everyone. Still, you might be wondering, why does this open source gift economy work? Is it some sort of magic increase machine? Well, intellectual property scholar James Boyle at Duke University says that it's, you know, a lot of fun to debate and imagine all the different explanations for why it works, but at the end, it's utterly irrelevant. With open source software, he writes, you have this global network of people that costs almost nothing to transmit, copy, and share materials. I kind of like this paragraph that he wrote, so I'm just going to read straight from it. So with these assumptions, he writes, it just doesn't matter why people do it. In lots of cases, they will do it. One person does it for the love of the species, another in hope for a better job, a third for the joy of solving puzzles, and so on. Each person has his own reserve price, the point at which he says, now I'm going to turn off Survivor and go create something. But on a global network, there's a lot of people. And with numbers that big and information overhead that small, even relatively hard projects will attract motivated and skilled people whose particular reserve price has been crossed. So, interestingly, the ability of free software or open source software, its ability to remain unrestricted relies actually on the existence of copyright law. It's another reason why copyright isn't inherently flawed, and it's not something that I argue should cease to exist. Intellectual property law should cease to exist. So the same Richard Stallman, who is the founder of the Free Software Foundation, coined the term copyleft instead of copyright. And he uses it to describe what he and others use to prevent their free software code from being turned into proprietary software. So each open software package or free software package comes with a contract. And that contract carries actually the force of copyright law. If you break this contract, you have broken the terms of agreement of this copyrighted material. But the code, while it is copyrighted, the contract states that it is nevertheless free and open for anyone to use. Just like we can go to the library and check out, if we have access to that library, any copyrighted book. Just because those books are copyrighted doesn't mean that we can't have access to it. So copyright isn't antithetical to the notion of openness. Getting back to this contract, these licenses, these copyleft licenses, use copyright law, but it flips it in order to serve the opposite of its usual purpose. Instead of a means of privatizing software, it's become a means of keeping the software free. So that if you do actually privatize the open work that other people have created and you copyright it yourself, you've actually violated, you know, copyright law. You violated that contract as well. So the basic premise of copyleft is that it uses the legal contractual force of copyright law to permit anyone to do anything with the code. You just can't add your own restrictions to it. You can't make it less free. So the importance of open source software is not that it introduces us to a wholly new idea, but it makes us see a very, very old idea very clearly in a contemporary context. After the internet, even newer kinds of gift economies have emerged. The prestigious Berklee College of Music has put a large amount of its academic content online. And it has done that by attaching what's called a Creative Commons license to that content. Just curious, how many people have heard of the organization Creative Commons? I imagine maybe no one. Oh, good, four people. Well, that's better than I had hoped, and that'll make some people very happy. Let me quickly explain what a Creative Commons license is. It's actually much like the sort of license that I was talking about with regard to open software or free software. And it's a license that is extremely easy to tailor. If you are a musician, you can go to the Creative Commons website. There's one for Ireland. There's one for, I think now, 32 countries in the world. And with a license that applies to 32 different jurisdictions that are legally binding, that have been drafted and vetted by very experienced lawyers. You can go to that website, and within 1 minute, by just clicking through menus and clicking through the different sorts of options you want, you can create a legally binding contract that is incredibly easy to make. And it tells users of your music what they can and cannot do. So let's say you're a musician and you actually do want your music to be freely shared on file share networks. Some musicians actually do want that because it's a way of generating free publicity for your music. It's kind of like an alternative form of radio. Although some musicians don't. But let's say you're a musician who does want that music circulated on the internet freely, but you feel really uncomfortable with someone digitally sampling, like the chorus of your song, and plucking it, bing, off of your sound recording and putting onto yours, or onto theirs. So within a minute, you can choose like all the different restrictions or lack of restrictions you want. So you can say, make mine available for to be freely downloaded, but you can't sample my music. Or it even gets down to, you can sample my music for non-commercial means, but you can't do it for commercial means. Or you can just select simply the easiest one, which is public domain. You make yours available to the public domain. So that's what Creative Commons is. It's a way of easily creating these licenses, drafting them within a minute. Very simple thing to do. That's what Berklee does with its content that is put online. And it encourages people to freely download more than 100 music lessons, for instance, that come with video, audio, and text files. And these range from tips on Afro-Cuban conga rhythms to turntable tricks for DJs. And so there are a number of reasons why Berkeley is wading knee deep into this gift economy. One, it's free and easy. It's the best proven way to get your stuff widely disseminated right now, says the director, or actually former director of Creative Commons, Glenn Otis Brown. He actually went on to a more lucrative job at Google. Two, it's their audience. A lot of people using the networks are music lovers, so they know that they're getting the attention of groups who are inclined to listen. So this project really demonstrates that file sharing is basically a great communication tool and that there are legitimate uses of this technology. And it had spread within a month to this content to over 10,000 websites generating over 1 million downloads during a period of 2 months. David Kusek, who is the associate vice president of that school, and other faculty members, some of them were actually surprised with this overwhelmingly positive response. And they were even more amazed to discover that users were uploading their own music to file sharing networks. But when you look at the big picture, most musicians, if you're not a songwriter, you make most of your money off of performing. So it is, it provides, as I said, exposure for next to nothing or nothing. Obviously creativity wants to be paid. That's absolutely true. But it also wants to spread freely, to be known in other instances. And the Creative Commons license makes it possible for people with little understanding of the law, often musicians, artists, are not the most business-minded people, just from my own experience, and that's not a bad thing. But these kind of, the Creative Commons license allows for a great amount of flexibility in telling people what audiences can do with their work. So let me return to my focus. Let me turn my focus now, that is, to a discussion on education and scholarship as I move slowly to the conclusion. I'm timing my lecture for about 40 minutes so that I can open up questions so that we'll have plenty of time to discuss. There are many consequences to this growing desire among information elites, or at least among some information elites, for greater control of every imaginable one and zero, or gene. This, in turn, has undermined the basic mechanics of Western science's gift economy, as I had said. And just turning towards the humanities, for instance, there is also a kind of gift economy, a gift economy that happened in journal publishing. Today and even before, we often, particularly in the U.S., but I also know from talking to European scholars that it was true, we as academics, especially on the tenure track, give away our copyrights to journals, to scholarly journals, peer-reviewed journals, in exchange for, to put it crassly, a kind of prestige that is awarded by these peer-reviewed journals. And this is still true today, the fact that we give away our copyrights. And it's increasingly true. The difference in today is that an increasing number of these journals are being bought by private companies, such as, for instance, Taylor & Francis, that are, retaining these copyrights and increasingly flexing their muscles about how we can use the knowledge that we have produced, knowledge that has been produced by being supported by a publicly funded institution. So we academic authors are in a precarious decision because our tenure and promotion hinges on publishing in peer-reviewed journals. And in most cases, as I said, we give up those copyrights. And this giving up, this reference to a gift economy, is spoken in academic terms as a journal article is a quote contribution to the field. By giving up our words and ideas to these journals, it was understood that we are increasing the intellectual richness of our area of study. If the knowledge we contributed for free is well respected by our peers, it will hopefully lead to raises or tenure. And unfortunately, as I said, this kind of academic gift economy is being threatened by the privatization of the scholarly information, by these journals being hoovered up, being sucked up being bought out by private companies like giants, such as Taylor and Francis. And this has led to a number of different problems just at the ground level of teaching in the classroom. In the United States, some publishers will ask for up to $1 per page to be reprinted in a course packet if you want to do it legally, or other staggering licensing fees. And you know, this oftentimes, if it costs $1 a page to include in a course packet, it exceeds the budgets of many undergraduate students. And it simply means that I have to drop and others have to drop this article from the course packet. So everyone loses in the end, because the point of scholarly research is to spread knowledge, not to lock it in. I also know, just from personal experience, at least four colleagues who have had to, well, when they published their scholarly monograph, their book, they ended up having to buy back the rights to journal articles that they used, that they wanted to be included in the book or adapted into the book. So copyright restrictions have also made it more and more difficult for scholars to quote just at the level of quotation and analyze certain texts without permission. The James Joyce estate, for instance, is notorious for flexing one of the heaviest restrictive copyright muscles when it comes to scholars wanting to quote from unpublished and often simply published writings. But to use a non-Joyce example, it's the reason why Indiana University Press withdrew from circulation a book about an obscure composer, the deceased Rebecca Clark, after the copyright owner of her unpublished writings cried foul. Leanne Curtis, the editor of the NIXT book, A Rebecca Clark Reader, told the Chronicle of Higher Education that the alleged infringements added up to 94 lines in a 241-page book. And for Curtis, the quoting of this unpublished scholarly work in this context was a fair use under U.S. law. But the University Press chose not to find out in court, because university presses in the U.S. Particularly have come under increasing budget cuts. So the free flow of information is becoming less and less free in many areas of research, as I said, in the area of genetics. And as I'm winding down, I just wanted to quickly relay a story, a really nice explanatory story that I recorded with during a conversation with the president of my university, the University of Iowa. His name is President David Skorton. And he's an interesting character because he's a prominent scientist, one of the most well-respected scientists in the U.S. Within the field of, I won't get too specific, but he works on the heart. but he's a prominent scientist, but he's an interesting character because he's also a jazz musician and performs every week. He plays saxophone. And he explained to me why these events, within the realm of scientific research at least, were so troubling for him and others. And he told me, at the most basic end of scientific research, any serious impediments to the free flow of ideas is to be avoided and resisted for two reasons. The number one reason is that it will eventually inhibit the march of science. It sounds corny, but I really believe it's true, he told me. And he breaks it down for me, this outsider from the realm of the arts and the humanities. So he said, if you take a scientific discovery that's really important in the medical field, and you actually try and walk backwards and see why F led to G, what E led to F, what caused D to lead to E, it's not a linear path often. It's not the sort of thing that you can predict today. So Dr. X is doing this research that's definitely going to lead to something somewhere down the line, but it's often a circuitous path. So in order to allow for those circuits to connect, you have to allow for openness and an openness of exchange. So in generalities, in very broad generalities, he told me, I think it's important to protect this freedom of exchange, and by the way, not just in the realms of the scientific research that you're talking about. So then he broke things off and said, but this has actually nothing to do with intellectual property when he somehow found himself talking about jazz music. Our conversation led from genetics to jazz music. He cut himself off, but before he cut himself off, and he says, "I think that the jazz solo can be viewed in some crackpot kind of way as an exercise in improvisation similar to the scientific experiments. In a scientific experiment, you have a set of knowledge, observations, wisdom, that are based on past observations and experience. You have some concept of a leap that might be taken, an educated guess, a postulate. Then you test it out by gathering information and see if it works or not." I thought about this often as he's sitting there, nervously waiting to step forward and take his saxophone solo. He continues, "You know, the chord structure, the past experience of playing music, the variations, what other people perhaps might have done with similar harmonic progressions that I've heard in the past, and then you step up and you try something that might work, kind of like a scientific experiment. It might work, it may not." And that's when he cut himself off, and he said, "That has nothing to do with copyright law. I don't know why we're talking about this." But in his response, I actually found something that I thought does relate to copyright law. So I pointed out to him that the existence of jazz music is predicated on the ability to borrow, experiment, and freely play with musical information, which is true of Skorton's arguments about science that he had just articulated to me. Jazz musicians are enabled by a certain kind of open source culture where pre-existing melodic fragments and larger musical frameworks are freely processed and reworked to create something new. But unfortunately, this kind of freedom that many of we university researchers, this freedom we have to play with genetic information if we're scientists, or other kinds of information, simply quoting from James Joyce, has been imperiled over the past three decades. The same time period, I should point out significantly, that the sector of intellectual property has grown as an extremely valuable and profitable area of industry. So this has pushed universities to try and lock up and privatize as many forms of information as possible, and sticking with, to conclude, one outrageous example that is sadly not that outrageous in the grand scheme of things. There is an undergraduate student at the University of South Florida in the United States named Peter Taborsky, who created on the university's facilities, he concocted an ammonia-absorbing substance that could be used for kitty litter, and then he patented it. But the university asserted its property rights because he did it on their premises. And this led to a lengthy court battle, which ended up with the courts deciding against the student, and the student ended up on a chain gang in prison. The president of, I'm sorry, the governor of the state of Florida, Lawton Chiles, before Jeb Bush took office, finally stepped in and removed him from the chain gang and at least put him in a minimum security prison. That's where the former undergraduate went. The university defended this situation by saying, well, you wouldn't, let's see, where is it? Oh, this is what the representative said. Quote, the case is no different for him than a student who steals books from the library or a VCR from the classroom. The university has taken heat in the media because that Taborsky wound up in prison, but the fact is he stole property that wasn't his. So the varied and sometimes mind-blowing stories collected in this talk vividly illustrate the perils of embracing an unregulated system solely managed by private interests. And this is what happens when an increasing amount of our physical and cultural resources become managed by private interests. So yes, as I said earlier, it's true that not all privatization schemes are necessarily bad. And in some cases, they actually can improve efficiency, but you can also point to other cases where they do not. But however, with regard to the realm of knowledge and information, without a guiding public policy that practices, without a guiding public policy that balances the profit motive of the few with the interests of most citizens, then we'll find ourselves in more absurd situations, such as an undergraduate ending up on a chain gang in prison. Or the last example that I'll very quickly conclude with, which is an anecdote related to me by James Boyle, the scholar who I quoted a couple times in this talk. And he wanted to quote a poem that was about the enclosure movement and the erasure of the commons. And one verse went, and this is from a poem that is centuries old, at least two or three centuries old, and it's by an anonymous person, hard to track down who wrote it. And the one verse wrote, "The law that locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from the commons, a geese will still a common lack till they go and steal it back." So anyway, he quoted this, and he sent his research assistant to find out what the exact date was, or a rough date was, because he had found on the internet over 18 sources that ascribe different dates to this poem. So the research assistant tracked down all 18 people or webmasters to ask, "Can you please give me a citation for that? We're publishing an article, and we're quoting this." And you know, this poem that has long been in the public domain, and gets 16 responses back, half of which are, you know, "We're very sorry. We've taken the poem off of our website. We didn't mean to infringe on your copyright," because clearly someone hadn't read it, you know, closely. Many hadn't read it closely. And he wrote back and said, no, please put it back up. You know, I don't want to prevent you from keeping this up. We just merely wanted to know where you where you attributed the date. And the other half wrote back and said, you know, we're sorry. We, you know, it's definitely down. And one newspaper wrote back and said, and the journalist has been disciplined. So thank you for your time, and I can take questions now.